Chapter 11. Grimionis. 44. They were sitting in the airfoil again, all three in the front, with Bailey once more in the middle and feeling the pressure on either side. Bailey was grateful to them for the care they unfailingly gave him, even though they were only machines, helpless to disobey instructions. And then he thought, why dismiss them with a word, machines? They're good machines in a universe of sometimes evil people. I have no right to favor the machines versus people subcategorization over the good versus evil one. And Daniil, at least, I cannot think of as a machine. Giscard said, I must ask again, sir. Do you feel well? Bailey nodded. Quite well, Giscard. I am glad to be out here with you two. The sky was, for the most part, white. Off-white, actually. There was a gentle wind, and it had felt distinctly cool until they got into the car. Daniil said, Partner Elijah, I was listening carefully to the conversation between yourself and Dr. Vasilia. I do not wish to comment unfavorably on what Dr. Vasilia has said, but I must tell you that, in my observation, Dr. Fastolf is a kind and courteous human being. He has never, to my knowledge, been deliberately cruel, nor has he, as nearly as I can judge, sacrificed a human being's essential welfare to the needs of his curiosity. Bailey looked at Daniil's face, which gave the impression, somehow, of intent sincerity. He said, Could you say anything against Dr. Fastolf, even if he were, in fact, cruel and thoughtless? I could remain silent. But would you? If by telling a lie I were to harm a truthful Dr. Vasilia by casting unjustified doubt on her truthfulness, and if by remaining silent I would harm Dr. Fastolf by lending further color to the true accusations against him, and if the two harms were, to my mind, roughly equal in intensity, then it would be necessary for me to remain silent. Harm through an active deed outweighs, in general, harm through passivity, all things being reasonably equal. Bailey said, Then, even though the first law states a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm, the two halves of the law are not equal? A fault of commission, you say, is greater than one of omission.
The words of the law are merely an approximate description of the constant variations in positron emotive force along the robotic brain paths, Partner Elijah. I do not know enough to describe the matter mathematically, but I know what my tendencies are.
And they are always to choose not doing overdoing, if the harm is roughly equal in both directions.
In general. And always to choose truth over non-truth, if the harm is roughly equal in both directions. In general, that is.
And in this case, since you speak to refute Dr. Vasilia and thus do her harm, you can only do so because the first law is mitigated sufficiently by the fact that you are telling the truth?
That is so, Partner Elijah.
Yet the fact is, you would say what you have said, even though it were a lie, provided Dr. Fastolf had instructed you with sufficient intensity to tell that lie when necessary, and to refuse to admit that you had been so instructed. There was a pause, and then Daniil said,
That is so, Partner Elijah.
It is a complicated mess, Daniil, but you still believe that Dr. Fastolf did not murder Jander Pennell?
My experience with him is that he is truthful, Partner Elijah, and that he would not do harm to friend Jander.
And yet Dr. Fastolf has himself described a powerful motive for his having committed the deed, while Dr. Vasilia has described a completely different motive, one that is just as powerful and is even more disgraceful than the first. Bailey brooded a bit. If the public were made aware of either motive, belief in Dr. Fastolf's guilt would be universal. Bailey turned suddenly to Giscard. How about you, Giscard? You have known Dr. Fastolf longer than Daniil has. Do you agree that Dr. Fastolf could not have committed the deed and could not have destroyed Jander on the basis of your understanding of Dr. Fastolf's character?
I do, sir.
Bailey regarded the robot uncertainly.
He was less advanced than Daniil. How far could he be trusted as a corroborating witness? Might he not be impelled to follow Daniil in whatever direction Daniil chose to take?
He said, "You knew Dr. Vasilia too, did you not?"
"I knew her very well," said Giscard.
"And liked her, I gather."
"She was in my charge for many years, and the task did not in any way trouble me."
"Even though she fiddled with your programming?"
"She was very skillful."
"Would she lie about her father? About Dr. Fastolf, that is?"
Giscard hesitated.
"No, sir, she would not."
"Then you are saying that what she says is the truth?"
"Not quite, sir. What I am saying is that she herself believes she is telling the truth."
"But why should she believe such evil things about her father to be true if, in actual fact, he is as kind a person as Daniil has just told me he was?"
Giscard said slowly,
"She has been embittered by various events in her youth, events for which she considers Dr. Fastolf to have been responsible, and for which he may indeed have been unwittingly responsible, to an extent. It seems to me it was not his intention that the events in question should have the consequences they did. However, human beings are not governed by the straightforward laws of robotics. It is therefore difficult to judge the complexities of their motivations under most conditions."
"True enough," muttered Bailey.
Giscard said, "Do you think the task of demonstrating Dr. Fastolf's innocence to be hopeless?"
Bailey's eyebrows moved toward each other in a frown.
"It may be. As it happens, I see no way out. And if Dr. Vasilia talks, as she is threatened to do..."
"But you ordered her not to talk. You explained that it would be dangerous to herself if she did."
Bailey shook his head.
"I was bluffing. I didn't know what else to say."
"Do you intend to give up, then?"
And Bailey said forcefully,
"No. If it were merely fast off, I might. After all, what physical harm would come to him? Roboticide is not even a crime, apparently, merely a civil offense. At worst, he will lose political influence and perhaps find himself unable to continue with his scientific labors for a time. I would be sorry to see that happen, but if there's nothing more I can do, then there's nothing more I can do. And if it were just myself, I might give up, too. Failure would damage my reputation, but who can build a brick house without bricks? I would go back to Earth a bit tarnished. I would lead a miserable and unclassified life, but that is the chance that faces every Earthman and woman. Better men than I have had to face that as unjustly. However, it is a matter of Earth. If I fail, then along with the grievous loss to Dr. Fastolf and to myself, there would be an end for any hope Earth people might have to move out of Earth and into the galaxy generally. For that reason, I must not fail. And I must keep on somehow as long as I am not physically thrust off this world."
Having ended in what was almost a whisper, he suddenly looked up and said in a peevish tone,
"Why are we sitting here parked, Giscard? Are you running the motor for your own amusement?"
"With respect, sir," said Giscard, "you have not told me where to take you."
"True. I beg your pardon, Giscard. First, take me to the nearest of the community personals that Dr. Vasilia made mention of. You two may be immune to such things, but I have a bladder that needs emptying. After that, find some place nearby where I can get something to eat. I have a stomach that needs filling. And after that..."
"Yes, partner Elijah?"
asked Daniil.
"To tell you the truth, Daniil, I don't know. However, after I attend to these purely physical needs, I will think of something."
And how Bailey wished he could believe that.
45.
The airfoil did not skim the ground for long. It came to a halt, swaying a bit, and Bailey felt the usual odd tightening of his stomach. That small unsteadiness told him he was in a vehicle, and it drove away the temporary feeling of being safe within walls and between robots. Through the glass ahead and on either side, and backward if he craned his neck, was the whiteness of sky and the greenness of foliage, all amounting to outside, that is, to nothing. He swallowed uneasily. They had stopped at a small structure. Bailey said,
"Is this the community personal?"
Daniil said,
"It is the nearest of a number on the Institute grounds, partner Elijah."
"Oh, you found it quickly. Are these structures also included in the map that has been pumped into your memory?
That is the case, Partner Elijah.
Is this one in use now?
It may be, Partner Elijah, but 3 or 4 may use it simultaneously.
Is there room for me?
Very likely, Partner Elijah.
Well, then let me out. I'll go there and see.
The robots did not move. Giscard said, Sir, we may not enter with you.
Yes, I am aware of that, Giscard.
We will not be able to guard you properly, sir.
Bailey frowned.
The lesser robot would naturally have the more rigid mind, and Bailey suddenly recognized the danger that he would simply not be allowed out of their sight, and therefore not allowed to enter the personal. He put a note of urgency into his voice and turned his attention to Daniil, who might be expected to more nearly understand human needs.
I can't help that, Giscard. Daniil, I have no choice in the matter. Let me out of the car.
Giscard looked at Bailey without moving, and, for one horrid moment, Bailey thought the robot would suggest that he unburden himself in the nearby field, in the open, like an animal. The moment passed. Daniil said,
I think we must allow Partner Elijah to have his way in this respect.
Whereupon Giscard said to Bailey, If you can wait for a short while, sir, I will approach the structure first. Bailey grimaced. Giscard walked slowly toward the building and then, deliberately, circumnavigated it. Bailey might have predicted the fact that once Giscard disappeared, his own sense of urgency would increase. He tried to distract his own nerve endings by staring around at the prospect. After some study, he became aware of thin wires in the air, here and there, fine, dark hairs against the white sky. He did not see them, to begin with. What he saw first was an oval object sliding along beneath the clouds. He became aware of it as a vehicle, and realized that it was not floating but was suspended from a long horizontal wire. He followed that long wire with his eyes, forward and back, noting others of the sort. He then saw another vehicle farther off, and yet another still farther off. The farthest of the three was a featureless speck, whose nature he understood only because he had seen the nearer ones. Undoubtedly, these were cable cars for internal transportation from one part of the Robotics Institute to another.
How spread out it all was, thought Bailey. How needlessly the Institute consumed space.
And yet, in doing so, it did not consume the surface. The structures were sufficiently widely spaced so that the greenery seemed untouched, and the plant and animal life continued, Bailey imagined, as they might in emptiness. Solaria, Bailey remembered, had been empty. No doubt all the spacer worlds were empty, since Aurora, the most populous, was so empty, even here in the most built-up region of the planet. For that matter, even Earth, outside the cities, was empty. But there were the cities, and Bailey felt a sharp pang of homesickness, which he had to push to one side. Daniil said,
Ah, friend Giscard has completed his examination.
Giscard was back, and Bailey said tartly,
Well, will you be so kind as to grant me permission?
He stopped. Why expend sarcasm on the impenetrable hide of a robot? Giscard said, It seems quite certain that the personal is unoccupied.
Good, then get out of my way.
Bailey flung open the door of the airfoil and stepped out into the gravel of a narrow path. He strode rapidly, with Daniil following. When he reached the door of the structure, Daniil wordlessly indicated the contact that would open it. Daniil did not venture to touch the contact himself. Presumably, thought Bailey, to have done so without specific instructions would have indicated an intention to enter, and even the intention was not permitted. Bailey pushed the contact and entered, leaving the two robots behind. It was not until he was inside that it occurred to him that Giscard could not possibly have entered the personal to see that it was unoccupied, that the robot must have been judging the matter from external appearance, a dubious proceeding at best. And Bailey realized, with some discomfort,
that for the first time he was isolated and separated from all protectors, and that the protectors on the other side of the door couldn't easily enter if he were suddenly in trouble. What then if he were, at this moment, not alone? What if some enemy had been alerted by Vasilia, who knew he would be in search of a personal? And what if that enemy was in hiding right now in the structure? Bailey grew suddenly and uncomfortably aware that, as would not have been the case on Earth, he was totally unarmed. 46. To be sure, the structure was not large. There were small urinals, side by side, half a dozen of them. Small wash basins, side by side, again, half a dozen. No showers, no clothes fresheners, no shaving devices. There were half a dozen stalls, separated by partitions and with small doors to each. Might there not be someone waiting inside one of them? The doors did not come down to the ground. Moving softly, he bent and glanced under each door, looking for any sign of legs. He then approached each door, testing it, swinging it open tensely, ready to slam it shut at the least sign of anything untoward, and then to dash to the door that led to the outside. All the stalls were empty. He looked around to make sure there were no other hiding places. He could find none. He went to the door to the outside and found no indication of a way of locking it. It occurred to him that there would naturally be no way of locking it. The personal was clearly for the use of several men at the same time. Others would have to be able to enter at need. Yet he could not very well leave and try another, for the danger would exist at any. And besides, he could delay no longer. For a moment he found himself unable to decide which of the series of urinals he should use. He could approach and use any of them. So could anyone else. He forced the choice of one upon himself, and aware of openness all around, was afflicted at once with bashful bladder. He felt the urgency, but had to wait impatiently for the feeling of apprehension at the possible entrance of others to dissipate itself. He no longer feared the entrance of enemies, just the entrance of anyone. And then he thought, the robots will at least delay anyone approaching. With that, he managed to relax. He was quite done, greatly relieved, and about to turn to a wash basin when he heard a moderately high-pitched, rather tense voice.
Are you Elijah Bailey?
Bailey froze. After all his apprehension and all his precautions, he had been unaware of someone entering. In the end, he had been entirely wrapped up in the simple act of emptying his bladder, something that should not have taken up even the tiniest fraction of his conscious mind. Was he getting old? To be sure, there seemed no threat of any kind in the voice he heard. It seemed empty of menace. It may have been that Bailey simply felt certain, and had the sure confidence within him, that Daniil, at least, if not Giscard, would not have allowed a threat to enter. What bothered Bailey was merely the entrance. In his whole life, he had never been approached, let alone addressed, by a man in a personal. On Earth, that was the most strenuous taboo. And on Solaria, and until now on Aurora, he had used only one-person personals. The voice came again, impatient.
Come, you must be Elijah Bailey.
Slowly, Bailey turned. It was a man of moderate height, delicately dressed in well-fitted clothing in various shades of blue. He was light-skinned, light-haired, and had a small mustache that was a shade darker than the hair on his head. Bailey found himself staring with fascination at the small strip of hair on the upper lip. It was the first time he had seen a spacer with a mustache. Bailey said, and was filled with shame at speaking in a personal,
I am Elijah Bailey.
His voice, even in his own ears, seemed a scratchy and unconvincing whisper. The spacer seemed to find it unconvincing, certainly. He said, narrowing his eyes and staring,
The robots outside said Elijah Bailey was in here, but you don't look at all the way you looked on Hyperwave, not at all.
That foolish dramatization, thought Bailey fiercely.
No one would meet him to the end of time without having been preliminarily poisoned by that impossible representation. No one would accept him as a human being at the start, as a fallible human being. And when they discovered the fallibility, they would, in disappointment, consider him a fool.
He turned resentfully to the wash basin and splashed water, then shook his hands vaguely in the air, while wondering where the hot air jet might be found. The spacer touched a contact and seemed to pluck a thin bit of absorbent fluff out of midair.
"Thank you," said Bailey, taking it. "That was not me in the hyperwave show. It was an actor."
"I know that, but they might have picked one that looked more like you, mightn't they?"
It seemed to be a source of grievance to him.
"I want to speak to you."
"How did you get past my robots?"
That was another source of grievance, apparently.
"I nearly didn't," said the spacer. "They tried to stop me, and I only had one robot with me. I had to pretend I had to get in here on an emergency basis, and they searched me. They absolutely laid hands on me to see if I was carrying anything dangerous. I'd have you up on charges if you weren't an Earthman. You can't give robots the kind of orders that embarrass a human being."
"I'm sorry," said Bailey stiffly, "but I am not the one who gave them their orders. What can I do for you?"
"I want to speak to you."
"You are speaking to me. Who are you?"
The other seemed to hesitate, then said,
"Grimianus."
"Centurix Grimianus?"
"That's right."
"Why do you want to speak to me?"
For a moment, Grimianus stared at Bailey, apparently with embarrassment. Then he mumbled,
"Well, as long as I'm here, if you don't mind, I might as well."
And he stepped toward the line of urinals.
Bailey realized, with the last refinement of horrified queasiness, what it was Grimianus intended to do. He turned hastily and said, "I'll wait for you outside."
"No, no, don't go,"
said Grimianus desperately, in what was almost a squeak.
"This won't take a second, please."
It was only that Bailey now wanted just as desperately to talk to Grimianus and did not want to do anything that might offend the other and make him unwilling to talk. Otherwise, he would not have been willing to accede to the request. He kept his back turned and squinted his eyes nearly shut in a sort of horrified reflex. And it was only when Grimianus came up around him, his hands kneading a fluffy towel of his own, that Bailey could relax again, after a fashion.
"Why do you want to speak to me?"
he said again.
"Gladia, the woman from Solaria?"
Grimianus looked dubious and stopped.
"I know Gladia,"
said Bailey coldly.
"Gladia viewed me, tridimensionally, you know, and told me you had asked about me. And she asked me if I had in any way mistreated a robot she owned, a human-looking robot like one of those outside."
"Well, did you, Mr. Grimianus?"
"No! I didn't even know she owned a robot like that until... Did you tell her I did?"
"I was only asking questions, Mr. Grimianus."
Grimianus had made a fist of his right hand and was grinding it nervously into his left. He said intensely,
"I don't want to be falsely accused of anything, and especially where such a false accusation would affect my relationship with Gladia."
Bailey said, "How did you find me?"
Grimianus said,
"She asked me about that robot and said you had asked about me. I had heard you had been called to Aurora by Dr. Fastolf to solve this puzzle about the robot. It was on the hyperwave news, and..."
The words ground out as though they were emerging from him with the utmost difficulty.
"Go on,"
said Bailey.
"I had to talk to you and explain that I had had nothing to do with that robot. Nothing! Gladia didn't know where you were, but I thought Dr. Fastolf would know."
"So you called him?"
"Oh, no, I don't think I'd have the nerve to. He's such an important scientist. But Gladia called him for me. She's that kind of person. He told her you had gone to see his daughter, Dr. Vasilia Aliena. That was good because I know her."
"Yes, I know you do," said Bailey.
Grimianus looked uneasy.
"How did you... Did you ask her about me, too?"
His uneasiness seemed to be degenerating to misery.
"I finally called Dr. Vasilia, and she said you had just left, and I'd probably find you at some community personal, and this one is the closest to her establishment. I was sure there would be no reason for you to delay in order to find a farther one. I mean, why should you?"
You reason quite correctly, but how is it you got here so quickly?
I work at the Robotics Institute, and my establishment is on the Institute grounds. My scooter brought me here in minutes.
Did you come here alone?
Yes, with only one robot. The scooter is a two-seater, you see.
And your robot is waiting outside?
Yes.
Tell me again why you want to see me.
I've got to make sure you don't think I've had anything to do with that robot. I never even heard of him till this whole thing exploded in the news. So, can I talk to you now?
Yes, but not here, said Bailey firmly. Let's get out.
How strange it was, thought Bailey, that he was so pleased to get out from behind walls and into the outside. There was something more totally alien to this personal than anything else he had encountered on either Aurora or Solaria. Even more disconcerting than the fact of planet-wide indiscriminate use had been the horror of being openly and casually addressed, of behavior that drew no distinction between this place and its purpose and any other place and purpose. The book films he had viewed had said nothing of this. Clearly, as Fastolf had pointed out, they were not written for Earth people, but for Aurorans and, to a lesser extent, for possible tourists from the other 49 spacer worlds. Earth people, after all, almost never went to the spacer worlds, least of all to Aurora. They were not welcome there. Why, then, should they be addressed? And why should the book films expand on what everyone knew? Should they make a fuss over the fact that Aurora was spherical in shape, or that water was wet, or that one man might address another freely in a personal? Yet did that not make a mockery of the very name of the structure? Yet Bailey found himself unable to avoid thinking of the women's personals on Earth, where, as Jesse had frequently told him, women chattered incessantly and felt no discomfort about it. Why women, but not men? Bailey had never thought seriously about it before, but had accepted it merely as custom, as unbreakable custom. But if women, why not men? It didn't matter. The thought only affected his intellect, and not whatever it was about his mind that made him feel overwhelming and ineradicable distaste for the whole idea. He repeated,
"Let's get out."
Grimianus protested,
"But your robots are out there."
"So they are. What of it?"
"But this is something I want to talk about privately. Man to... man."
He stumbled over the phrase.
"I suppose you mean spacer to Earthman."
"If you like."
"My robots are necessary. They are my partners in my investigation."
"But this has nothing to do with the investigation. That's what I'm trying to tell you."
"I'll be the judge of that," said Bailey firmly, walking out of the personal.
Grimianus hesitated, and then followed. 47. Daniil and Giscard were waiting, impassive, expressionless, patient. On Daniil's face, Bailey thought he could make out a trace of concern, but on the other hand, he might merely be reading that emotion into those inhumanly human features. Giscard, the less human-looking, showed nothing, of course, even to the most willing personifier. A third robot waited as well, presumably that of Grimianus. He was simpler in appearance even than Giscard, and had an air of shabbiness about him. It was clear that Grimianus was not very well-to-do. Daniil said, with what Bailey automatically assumed to be the warmth of relief,
"I am pleased that you are well, Partner Elijah."
"Entirely well. I am curious, however, about something. If you had heard me call out an alarm from within, would you have come in?"
"At once, sir," said Giscard.
"Even though you are programmed not to enter personals?"
"The need to protect a human being, you in particular, would be paramount, sir."
"That is so, Partner Elijah," said Daniil.
"I'm glad to hear that," said Bailey. "This person is Centurix Grimianus. Mr. Grimianus, this is Daniil and this is Giscard."
Each robot bent his head solemnly. Grimianus merely glanced at them and lifted one hand in indifferent acknowledgement. He made no effort to introduce his own robot. Bailey looked around. The light was distinctly dimmer. The wind was brisker, the air was cooler, the sun was completely hidden by clouds. There was a gloom to the surroundings that did not seem to affect Bailey,
who continued to be delighted at having escaped from the personal. It lifted his spirits amazingly that he was actually experiencing the feeling of being pleased at being outside. It was a special case, he knew, but it was a beginning, and he could not help but consider it a triumph. Bailey was about to turn to Graminus to resume the conversation when his eye caught movement. Walking across the lawn came a woman with an accompanying robot. She was coming toward them, but seemed totally oblivious to them. She was clearly making for the personal. Bailey put out his arm in the direction of the woman, as though to stop her, even though she was still 30 meters away, and muttered, "Doesn't she know that's a men's personal?"
"What?" said Graminus.
The woman continued to approach, while Bailey watched in total puzzlement. Finally, the woman's robot stepped to one side to wait, and the woman entered the structure. Bailey said helplessly,
"But she can't go in there."
Graminus said,
"Why not? It's communal."
"But it's for men."
"It's for people," said Graminus.
He seemed utterly confused.
"Either sex? Surely you can't mean that."
"Any human being. Of course I mean it. How would you want it to be? I don't understand."
Bailey turned away. It had not been many minutes before that he had thought that open conversation in a personal was the acme in bad taste of things not done. If he had tried to think of something worse yet, he would have completely failed to dredge up the possibility of encountering a woman in a personal. Convention on Earth required him to ignore the presence of others in the large community personals on that world, but not all the conventions ever invented would have prevented him from knowing whether a person passing him was a man or a woman. What if, while he had been in the personal, a woman had entered, casually, indifferently, as this one had just done? Or worse still, what if he had entered a personal and found a woman already there? He could not estimate his reaction. He had never weighed the possibility, let alone met with such a situation, but he found the thought totally intolerable. And the book films had told him nothing about that either. He had viewed those films in order that he might not approach the investigation in total ignorance of the Auroran way of life, and they had left him in total ignorance of all that was important. Then how could he handle this triply knotted puzzle of Jander's death, when at every step he found himself lost in ignorance? A moment before he had felt triumph at a small conquest over the terrors of outside, but now he was faced with the feeling of being ignorant of everything, ignorant even of the nature of his ignorance. It was now, while fighting not to picture the woman passing through the airspace lately occupied by himself, that he came near to utter despair. 48. Again Giscard said, and in a way that made it possible to read concern into his words, if not into the tone, "Are you unwell, sir? Do you need help?" Bailey muttered,
No, I'm all right. But let's move away. We're in the path of people wishing to use that structure."
He walked rapidly toward the airfoil that was resting in the open stretch beyond the gravel path. On the other side was a small two-wheeled vehicle with two seats, one behind the other. Bailey assumed it to be Graminus's scooter. His feeling of depression and misery, Bailey realized, was accentuated by the fact that he felt hungry. It was clearly past lunchtime, and he had not eaten. He turned to Graminus.
"Let's talk, but if you don't mind, let's do it over lunch. That is, if you haven't already eaten, and if you don't mind eating with me."
"Where are you going to eat?"
"I don't know. Where does one eat at the Institute?"
Graminus said,
"Not at the community diner. We can't talk there."
"Is there an alternative?"
"Come to my establishment," said Graminus at once. "It isn't one of the fancier ones here. I'm not one of your high executives. Still, I have a few serviceable robots, and we can set a decent table. I tell you what, I'll get on my scooter with Brundish, my robot, you know, and you follow me. You'll have to go slowly, but I'm only a little over a kilometer away. It'll take just 2 or 3 minutes."
He moved away at an eager half-run. Bailey watched him and thought there seemed to be a kind of gangly youthfulness about him. There was no easy way of actually judging his age, of course. Spacers didn't show age, and Gromionists might easily be 50. But he acted young. Almost what an Earthman would consider teenage young, Bailey wasn't sure exactly what there was about him that gave that impression. Bailey turned suddenly to Daniil.
Do you know Gromionist, Daniil?
I have never met him before, partner Elijah.
You, Giscard?
I have met him once, sir, but only in passing.
Do you know anything about him, Giscard?
Nothing that is not apparent on the surface, sir.
His age, his personality?
No, sir.
Gromionist shouted,
Ready?
His scooter was humming rather roughly. It was clear that it was not air-jet-assisted. The wheels would not leave the ground. Brundage sat behind Gromionus. Giscard, Daniil, and Bailey moved quickly into their airfoil once again. Gromionus moved outward in a loose circle. Gromionus's hair flew backward in the wind, and Bailey had a sudden sensation of how the wind must feel when one traveled in an open vehicle such as a scooter. He was thankful he was totally enclosed in an airfoil, which suddenly seemed to him a much more civilized way of traveling. The scooter straightened out and darted off with a muted roar, Gromionus waving one hand in a follow-me gesture. The robot behind him maintained his balance with almost negligent ease and did not hold on to Gromionus's waist, as Bailey was certain a human being would have needed to. The airfoil followed. Although the scooter's smooth forward progression seemed high speed, that was apparently the illusion of its small size. The airfoil had some difficulty maintaining a speed low enough to avoid running it down.
Just the same, said Bailey thoughtfully. One thing puzzles me.
What is that, partner Elijah?
Asked Daniil.
Vasilia referred to this Gromionus disparagingly as a barber. Apparently he deals with hair, clothes, and other matters of personal human adornment. How is it, then, that he has an establishment on the grounds of the Robotics Institute?